Well, go ahead and grab your Bibles if you have them and turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Well, last week we were introduced to the controlling theme of this book, that there is this great reality called Havel, and that Havel both permeates and dominates everything in creation. We saw Solomon's first observation of Havel, namely the Havel of monotony, and he began there by posing a question about the meaning of life. He asked, what advantage or what profit does man have in all his labor? And then he went on to simply conclude that there is no real profit to man's life because all are on this monotonous treadmill called life heading toward death, after which will soon be forgotten. So his conclusion was, what's the point? Why amass wealth? Why make a name for myself? Why climb the corporate ladder? Why try to become skilled at a craft? But ultimately, what we concluded from last week is not so much that life is meaningless, but actually that it's deeply meaningful because this life has everything to do with eternity, has eternal lasting implications. We learned that a wise person lives humbly by having a realistic perspective of this life. They walk and navigate through life with a deep awareness that they're simply a creature living in the Creator's world. They don't buy into the lie that there's something new that will break them out of the mold of monotony or even bring new meaning or satisfaction. And then ultimately, even though there's nothing new under the sun, the Christian looks at this world differently because they've been given new eyes. They look to a day when all things will be made new, a new heaven, a new earth, a new body, a new song, will drink a new wine. And so while they experience the Havel just as much as the unbeliever, they walk and navigate this life with the great hope of what's to come because of Christ. But today we're still dealing with Solomon's observations. So we're going to start in verse 12 of chapter 1 and make our way all the way through verse 11 of chapter 2. And if you remember, I mentioned that Solomon is making a series of observations all the way through verse 25 of chapter 2. And so he just keeps spiraling down his black hole. And today we might see why. So let me go ahead and read it and we'll jump in and we'll start first by reading verses 12 through 18 of chapter 1. Solomon writes, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity in striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. And I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I realized that this also is striving after wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. Tough verse. Well, as we saw last week, Solomon has already made the observation about the absolute futility of life and that there doesn't seem to be any satisfying answer for how to break out of the futility of life. And so now what he's going to do with all of his wealth, power, wisdom, and intellect is perform a life experiment to see if there's any way to find meaning, purpose, or lasting satisfaction that will break him out of the havel of this existence. So verse 12, and here he's basically just repeating what he says in verse 1. Notice he states in verse 1, the words of the preacher, or Kohelet. And if you don't know what I mean by that, listen to last week. Kohelet, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And here in verse 12, he states, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. So what he's doing here by repeating this is basically just giving us his resume. He's telling us how great he is, how powerful he is, how wealthy he is, basically how much better he is than you or I. And the reason he does that is because in his experiment with life, he wants you and I to know that at his fingertips, he has all the wealth, power, wisdom, and intellect and resources to do what you and I have no ability to do. So he's going to take us on this experiment, and he wants us to take a lesson from his pursuit. And notice the intentionality of this experiment. He says in verse 13, and I set my mind, literally my heart, to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. Now, as I think most of you know, in in Hebrew thought, a reference to the heart was not a term in reference to mere desire or ambition. It wasn't about the emotions, but rather it was a reference to a person's control factory. So when a Hebrew spoke of the heart, they were usually speaking of the mind, emotions, and even the spiritual capacities of a person. In other words, the whole of the person. And so here, all he's trying to communicate is that it's not like he was just sitting in his kingdom and got bored one day and thought he'd go on an adventure. No, he brought all that he was, every single faculty of his being, to bear on this life experiment. Notice the doubling of the verbs in verse 13. He says, I set my heart both to seek and to explore. But notice how he's going to do it. He states he's going to seek and explore by wisdom. So he's not going out into the world and hoping he just trips and lands on something helpful, but rather not only has he set his mental, emotional, and spiritual capacities to pursue with all of his might and vigor the things under the sun, but he says that in all of this, the one thing that never left my side was wisdom. And so there's purpose in this pursuit. And so what he's doing here is he's essentially making a statement that since he's now observed all the toil with which man toils, the absolute monotony of this creation, and the havel that defines it all, he's made it his task to actually try and do something about it. He sets his mind to see if there's actually anything a person can do to try and break them free from the havel of this life. And the important thing to note here is that there is actually nothing that Solomon will leave unturned. He's going to pursue everything. He says, I will seek and explore all that has been done under heaven. And the reason I point that out to you is because if you, like me, you probably already set it in your mind to try and find something that he might miss. But he says that I've set my mind to explore all that has been done under heaven. And he has the ability and resources to do it. He is just beyond us. So we would do well to listen to Solomon. So what he's going to do now over these next few passages is basically use his five senses to see what's really going on under the sun. But before he gets there, the first thing he does in verses 13 through 18 is basically try and go the high road. Before he pursues life with his five senses, he's actually going to see if wisdom, knowledge, and understanding will break him free from the havel. And so he goes on this quest to see what wisdom might accomplish. And he leaves us right away with some observations from this pursuit. End of verse 13. Regarding wisdom, he states it is a grievous task. The term there is actually the Hebrew term for evil. So it is an evil task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted or burdened with. So what he's saying here is that man, really by his very nature, is hardwired by the Creator to look out at life and ask why. He has this insatiable drive to ask why. And what's interesting is he describes this task of wanting to know why as an evil affliction from the hand of God. And we'll see why once we get to verse 15. But the point here is that Solomon observes the nature of man and feels it, really even in his own experience, that this task of trying to discover meaning, purpose, and satisfaction through knowledge, reason, and wisdom is burdensome. And so he says in verse 14, I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity in striving after the wind. And so that's his conclusion about wisdom. And it isn't his conclusion just based off watching people pursue wisdom, but actually based on his own experience. What we have to remember about Solomon is that he was no fool. He was the wisest and smartest man that has ever walked the face of this earth. He was given a supernatural gift from God in the form of wisdom. I read to you from 1 Kings chapter 3. The author writes, God said to him, that's Solomon, because you have asked for this thing, wisdom, and have not asked for yourself long life, nor have you asked for riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself discernment to understand justice, behold, I have done according to your words. I have given you a wise and discerning heart or mind, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall one like you arise after you. I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you all your days. And then in chapter 4 we read, "Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind that is like the sand that is on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men." And then it just gives a list of names of some of the wise men in that day. "And his fame was known in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the walls. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. Men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom." And so I read that because I want you to know that Solomon, in all of his wisdom, knowledge, and discernment, is just beyond you. Even in our day, with all the technological advances and new discoveries, he's still just beyond you. He's got more discernment, more wisdom, more knowledge, more analysis than you'll ever possess. And his simple conclusion with regard to wisdom and the pursuit of knowledge is it's just an exercise of futility. It doesn't give you any more meaning. It doesn't give any better answers. It doesn't break you free from the tyranny of Havel. In fact, according to verse 18, the only thing knowledge and understanding ultimately gives you is grief. The more wisdom, the more knowledge, the more understanding, the more pain and sorrow. But we'll get there. So he says in verse 14, "Chasing for answers through wisdom, knowledge, and discernment is like chasing after the wind." I love that phrase. And the brilliant thing about that little phrase is that even if you knew where the wind was coming or where it was going, his point is, what would you catch it with? And even if you did catch the wind, his point is, what would you actually have? So let me just say, for those of you who are struggling from things like anxiety and depression, which are topics we'll keep coming back to throughout this book, maybe because you can't quite figure out what it is that you're supposed to be doing in this life, or where it is that you're supposed to be fitting in, or how it is that you can get to the next step. In other words, purpose and meaning. Solomon would ask, what are you chasing? What are you trying to grab onto that you think will satisfy? You're anxious and depressed because you're setting your mind and your heart to attain something, but Solomon says you don't even know how to grab it. And so all he's trying to get us to ask is, do we actually think there's something out there that will give us final purpose, meaning, or satisfaction? It's the drum he beats all throughout this book. So we just saw from Solomon last week that there's nothing new under the sun. But let's just say there is something new. Let's just say there is something to be found. Solomon's point is to say you don't even have the wisdom to recognize it. We keep hoping and thinking and feeling something will give us answers, that it will finally satisfy. And so when we think we have it, when we think we've finally attained it, we open our hands to discover nothing. And so we just keep proving Solomon true. And I think what's interesting about the pursuit of knowledge and wisdom is that because it doesn't ever produce what we think it promises to produce, in the end game, all knowledge and wisdom ultimately deliver is pain. It's the point of verse 18. Solomon will have some really good things to say about wisdom. In fact, his book itself is wisdom. But you have to keep in mind that there's a sense in which the only thing wisdom and knowledge ultimately gives you is sorrow. This is what he means in chapter 12 when he says, "Beyond this, my son, be warned. For the writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body." That's not a statement about novels and things like fiction, but a statement with regard to the use of wisdom and knowledge as a means of bringing meaning and release from the havel. It just leaves you weary, burdened, and sorrowful. Now, why is this? Well, look at verse 15. And he states it in the form of a proverb. He says, what is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. And so what he's saying here is there are bent and missing things in this world. And what's implied here is actually that God is the one that's done this. So the frustration with life is simple, right? The world is bent and we want things straight. We want things in order. We want to be able to solve the hardships of life. But Solomon says God has twisted this world and made things of this world to go missing. And we know this also from chapter 7, verse 13, where Solomon states, consider the work of God. For who is able to straighten what he has bent? I've had people tell me on occasion, maybe you've gotten this yourself, that if there is a God that exists, there's no way he could be the God of the Bible because there are just too many broken and twisted things in this world. And a good God, the God of the Bible, would never do that. To which my reply has always been and always will be, read Ecclesiastes. Not only is the God of the Bible the God of the broken, bent, and twisted things, but he's actually the creator and sustainer of the bent, broken, and twisted things. He could set this world straight in the blink of an eye, but the reality is that he, from his good pleasure, continues day after day to sustain the mess. War, famine, injustice, cancer, things that even in all of our intellectual advances still haven't been able to solve or understand why, he still sustains. And what we need to know about this is that there is actually purpose in the bent and missing pieces of this world. The reason God has done this is so that you and I might have a daily reminder that we are not him. You're simply a creature living in his world who's dependent on him for life, breath, and all things. And you have no ability to make straight what he has made bent. If you remember from last week, I mentioned that the reality of Havel is the result of God's curse on this world from Genesis chapter 3. And so the reason God cursed this world is because Adam and Eve ate of the fruit. They thought that if they ate of the fruit, that they could somehow be like God, knowing good and evil. And so when God cursed this world, he permanently bent it so that we as people would have constant reminder that we are not God, nor can we be like God. That's the purpose of the curse. And so Solomon says there are things in this world that are bent and missing. The reason there's frustration, the reason there is vexation is because you want things fixed, you want things made right, but you have no ability to do so. And so the mark of a wise person then is that they recognize that wisdom and understanding don't ultimately solve anything. They're unanswered and at the end of the day, unanswerable questions that will always exist. And so wise living accepts this fact and doesn't ultimately look to knowledge as the savior of the world. Politics won't do it. Right parenting won't do it. A job that highlights your skills won't do it. At best, those things might only relieve some of the pain and sorrow, but they have no ability to actually solve the problems of Havel. Which is why he labels knowledge and wisdom as Havel. Now in verse 17, he states, and I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. So not only did he go the high road and try to figure things out through wisdom and knowledge, which just produced grief and pain, but he also went the way of a fool, which we'll see in chapter 2. But all that produced was madness. So he simply concludes, I realize that this too is striving after the wind. So when it comes to the pursuit of wisdom as a means of trying to break you free from the Havel or give you a sense of purpose and meaning, Solomon's sole point is to say, in the end, there is no greater advantage to the wise man than there is to the fool, which is almost a direct quote from chapter 2. And if you think about that long enough, and If you come to accept Solomon's words, ironically, what you're actually accepting then is a kind of divine wisdom. And not the kind of wisdom that will break you free from the havel, but the kind of wisdom that will help free you from the reality of the sorrow and pain as described in verse 18. So I think one of the reasons why wisdom and knowledge creates such pain and sorrow is really because there's a sense in which too much wisdom and too much knowledge begins to elicit a kind of hope. Think politics, think philosophy, think gurus. They always fail. And since all wisdom and knowledge are subjected to the futility of this world, your hope begins to rest in something futile. There's nothing new under the sun, and so when your hope begins to rest in something under the sun, you're bound to just repeat history. Fail before, and it'll fail again. And so when that failure comes, it's accompanied with a great sorrow. So the wisdom of Solomon is, don't put your hope in wisdom or knowledge, but as he'll say later, the mark of a truly wise person is that they put their hope in the giver of wisdom. And not because putting your hope in the giver of wisdom somehow just magically makes all the problems of life go away, but because as the maker and sustainer of the bent and missing things, he alone knows what is good and straight and full. And so true wisdom, which comes from God, will help you navigate well in and through the havel, but just do not expect it to deliver you from the havel. So one of the things I really like about Solomon is his forthrightness. He doesn't pull any punches, and he's certainly not interested in misleading you. So he begins his book of wisdom by basically stating the havel of wisdom. But what he's going to do now in chapter 2 is just go the opposite route of wisdom. He's going to instead just pursue foolishness in the form of pleasure. So if he can't reason himself out of the havel, perhaps he can just anesthetize or numb himself to the reality of havel. And this is such an important passage. Quite frankly, we live in a place where we have every form of pleasure at our fingertips. And the problem with that is not so much that pleasure in and of itself is evil. God created even that. Pleasure was his idea. But because pleasure has this way of distracting us just long enough to not have to consider our ways before the Creator. So maybe there's something Solomon here can teach us here. So chapter 2, and we'll go all the way through verse 11. Solomon writes, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself. And behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done under the sun, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity in striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. So in this section, we're going to begin to see really why Solomon is truly beyond us. He's got resources and abilities that we just cannot fathom. And so verse 1 is basically just telling us he's going to bring all he is and has to test himself. Quite literally could be rendered as to see if there's anything good in pleasure. So what he's doing now is entering into his experiment. He's simply going to see if the pursuit of pleasure, joy, and happiness will bring him any kind of lasting satisfaction or release him from the havel of life. But before we see what he does, he gives his conclusion from the outset. And we see that right here at the end of verse 1, where he labels pleasure as futility. And then he expands on that conclusion here in verse 2 when he states, I said of laughter, it is madness, literally insanity, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? And given the way it's constructed, verse 2 could actually be taken as kind of a proverb. And so if you're at all familiar with Hebrew proverbs, and you know the concepts here, the two concepts should really be read together as a kind of parallel. And so what he's saying here then is not so much that laughter and pleasure are evil, but that in the grand scheme of a person's life, there's really no ultimate value in the temporal experiences of laughter and pleasure. You'll often hear at a funeral how a person lived a happy or full life. I actually just heard this at a funeral a few weeks ago. You'll hear how they were always laughing or joyous or could light up a room when they walked in, or maybe during the eulogy, they'll rehearse all the different things the person's accomplished or experienced in their life, maybe all the countries they visited or things that they saw. But Solomon would go to that funeral and ask, what did any of that accomplish? None of it brought any more meaning or gave any more release from the reality of Havel. His conclusion here is to say nothing more than that in the final analysis of a person's life, what value do any of the experiences of laughter and pleasure give you once you're gone? At best, they might numb you for a season, but they never deliver. And no matter how much we might understand or hear Solomon on this, the reality is that we never cease to grope. We never stop searching. We never stop desiring pleasure. And the reason for that is actually due to something Solomon himself states in the next chapter, which is that God has placed eternity on every man's heart. Which means you can't actually stop groping. You were designed to long and search for satisfaction. You were created, whether you knew it or not, for pleasure. But while you were meant to find satisfaction in something outside of yourself, you were meant to find it in something much better, in something much more transcendent than any finite created thing. You can't fill an eternal void with something finite, which is why he concludes that the pursuit of temporary laughter and pleasure is madness or insanity. It can't give you what you were designed to experience. So let's see Solomon's experiment. What did he actually do before he came to this conclusion? And we're actually going to see life stages here, so maybe watch to see where you fit in. He states in verse 3, I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. Now, here's actually where some commentators get their idea that Solomon basically spent most of his life in a drunken state, and therefore the book of Ecclesiastes is nothing more than the musings of an angry, depressed drunk. But the problem with that is this verse. He states, I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely. And more than that, he did it to see how he might actually take hold of folly. So it's a statement about the use of alcohol. And really, if we cross-reference to 1 Kings, all that comes with alcohol, namely partying and feasting as a solution to the emptiness of life. So 1 Kings chapter 4, you don't have to turn there, but the author describes what it took to supply and sustain just one day of Solomon's parties. And keep in mind, he did this for an extended period of time. He writes, Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, which was about 50 gallons, I looked it up, and 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed oxen, 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, in fattened fowl. So most commentators agree that this would feed anywhere from 15 to 20,000 people a day. So Solomon threw and partook of parties night after night after night after night for extended periods of time that you and I just cannot fathom. He had the best meat, the best wines, the best decoration, and the best entertainment, but eventually he gets tired and moves on. So look at where he goes next, verse 4. He states, I enlarged my works. So what he does here is he leaves the party scene and to see what kind of satisfaction work might bring him. And you know what this is. You have that point in your life where you love hanging out with your friends and having very little responsibility. But that day eventually comes where sitting around and doing literally nothing creates a kind of anxiety in you. You feel you're wasting your days and you should be doing something productive. You just grow tired of the leisure and want to put your hand to a task. And so this is exactly what Solomon does. He says, I build houses for myself. And just to get an idea about this, Solomon's temple, which was a magnificent piece of architecture, took him 7 years to build. But according to 1 Kings 7, it took him 13 years to build his house. So it doesn't really matter how much money you have. Solomon's house is just better. He says, I planted vineyards for myself, probably where he got all his wine. I made gardens and parks for myself. And we're not talking little neighborhood parks. We're talking national forests. And I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. And so not only did he build things like national parks, but also built the infrastructure to sustain these things. And so what we see Solomon doing here is after he grows tired of the day in and day out experiences of nothingness that party and alcohol give him, he wants to see if creating and building something of substance might give him actual meaning, purpose, or satisfaction. And there's something that happens in the soul, and I think you know what I'm talking about. When you spend time and energy laboring over your work, and then you take a step back to enjoy the final product, there's something built into labor by God's design that gives us satisfaction. So Solomon did this over and over again with all kinds of projects and ventures, but notice, even that grows old, so he moves on. Verse 7. I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. Now he sits in his giant home and never has to lift a finger. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. So not only did he go to the zoo, but he owned the zoo, and it was better than any that came before him. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. And I like the way that this one is phrased because it's almost like he doesn't even know what he has. He can't even keep track of it. So he says that I have treasure that is befitting of kings. And then he says, I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. So not only does he have what you can only imagine is probably one of the greatest musical assemblies the world has ever heard and could create sounds of beauty like the world will never hear again, but also uninhibited sexual pleasure. We know from 1 Kings chapter 11 that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He had, as one man put it, every age, shape, color, and demographic you could think of that makes Hugh Hefner look like a monk. So the point here is that when it comes to Solomon, we just have no idea what we're actually dealing with. He had abilities, freedom, and resources that are so far beyond us that even our imaginations fail to accurately depict his position. So look at what this produces, verse 9. He says, then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. So while money makes most people shallow and lonely, this says Solomon became popular. And this idea of him becoming great isn't a reference to power, but popularity. He was famous. He was beloved. He was great. And so he enjoyed celebrity status. But he says that at the end of verse 9, that in all of this, and this is key, my wisdom also stood by me. And his point in saying that here is that he wants us to remember that in the midst of him pursuing all of his prosperity, pleasure, and fame, he never forgets his purpose. He never gets so caught up and lost in his pleasure that he lost sight of his goal to see if pleasure could release him from the havel of life. So then in verse 10, he kind of just gives us a conclusion. He states, "All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor." So for the first time in Ecclesiastes, we finally have what almost sounds like an optimistic statement. After 1.5 chapters of depression, it seems we're finally coming to some conclusions about how to break out of the havel of life. He simply states here what I mentioned earlier, that there's something that happens in the soul when you step back from your labor to see what you've accomplished. There's reward in that. Even in the book of Genesis, God has joy and gladness in his creation. And so Kohelet says, "My heart was pleased because of all my labor." But let's keep reading. Verse 11. "Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity in striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun." So he's right back in his hole again. But here's his point in saying this, and it's such an important conclusion. Solomon had pleasure. He experienced joy. He experienced reward. No doubt his experiment appeased all five of his senses to the max. But here's his conclusion. Laughter, pleasure, and reward, at the end of the day, last for a season, but it comes and goes like the wind. So he spent who knows how much of his life carrying out this experiment. Commentators debate, but no one really knows. He put all of his wealth, power, freedom, and resources into this experiment. He gave himself 700 wives and 300 concubines, a temple for which he commanded and oversaw 183,300 men in a house so large and intricate it took him 13 years to build, parties that lasted for a week, for which he had to, on a daily basis, slaughter hills of cattle to feed his guests. You and I will never attend a party like this. He pursued labor, love, and leisure until he had his fill. And his great conclusion, when all was said and done, is all is vanity. These things satisfied for a season, but ultimately failed. They gave me satisfaction for a moment, but ultimately failed. And so Solomon is right back where he started in the beginning. So we live in a society that pushes this thing called the American dream. And we live in a culture that's probably more Solomonic than any other culture. We're just closer to being like Solomon than any generation before us. We have the ability to run, chase, or pursue almost anything our heart desires. I don't care if it's some kind of food, trinket, job, or relationship. And here's the thing, nowhere in this text or anywhere in the Bible is pleasure ever condemned, which is what makes it so dangerous. But the wisdom of Solomon is that there is nothing on earth that will bring you ultimate, final, lasting satisfaction or free you from the havel of this life. And I'm just going to be honest, there are some of you in this room right now who simply do not believe this. And I know that because despite what you say, your life bears witness against you. And I'm not saying that because I've looked at your checkbook. I'm saying that because things like depression, anxiety, worry, fear, and doubt are all symptoms of a heart that is not satisfied. You have a thirsting soul that's never been quenched. So here's where I think we need to go with this. Solomon says in the next chapter, and I mentioned this earlier, that God has placed eternity on every man's heart. And what he means there is that you and I have a kind of capacity that's eternal. We have this eternal void that's meant to be filled. We know there's something more. But the problem is that we're busy spending endless amounts of energy trying to fill the eternal void with something finite, which is why nothing ever satisfies. You were created for pleasure. The Bible is clear about that. But the only real way to actually fill the void is to do it with something eternal. So one of my favorite quotes comes from a book entitled The Weight of Glory, which was a sermon later published into a book by C.S. Lewis. And actually, there's two quotes in there I like. The first one is when he says, "I didn't come to God to make me happy. I always knew a bottle of port could do that." But the second one is this, and if you've been in church any length of time, you've heard it before. He said, "If there lurks in most modern minds the notion that to desire our own good and earnestly to hope for the enjoyment of it is a bad thing, I submit that this notion has crept in from Kant and the Stoics and is no part of the Christian faith." So Kant believed that the more you enjoyed something, the cheaper you actually made it. You lessened its value. And so Lewis here is just saying that the Christian life is the exact opposite. The more you enjoy something, the more virtuous you actually prove it to be. So he goes on, "Indeed, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in the slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by an offer of a holiday at sea. We are far too easily pleased." And that's so true, because it's biblical. And Paul confirms this in Romans 1 when he states that when sin broke this world, you and I, in our pride and arrogance, because we think we know better, it took our eyes off the infinite Creator and cast them onto the finite creation, believing in our hearts that creation is far better and far more satisfying than the Creator. We bought into the lie that there's more pleasure, joy, and satisfaction in wooing our soul with creation rather than satisfying it in Christ. And just because you're a Christian doesn't mean this problem's disappeared for you. Some of you feel this reality constantly. You feel the pull and the tug of this world daily. So until you come to the conviction, and I mean, you have an honest wrestling with your life and your faith to discover your idolatry, you will be stuck in the mud until you die. You will go to your grave anxious and longing because you have not yet learned the fullness of what Christ would have for you. You think that if you could just fix your marriage, if you could just get your health back, if you could just get that job, or if you could just get that relationship, which, by the way, are just veiled ways for stating the kind of pleasure you're seeking, you could finally come back and focus on Christ. You could push away the darkness and come to the light. You could finally come back to the joy of your salvation. And all you're doing when you say that is proving that you don't yet understand that Christ is altogether satisfying in and through those things, not despite those things. Or as Paul would say, when you have much or when you have little. So listen, your marriage will never be what it's supposed to be until it has at its center Christ. Because that fun little cuddly and cute text messaging stuff that sustained your early years will never in the long run sustain you during the hardships and the sufferings that beat against the boat of your marriage. And I know unbelievers can have a happy marriage. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that until you have Christ, you will never know and experience the fullness and the beauty of what marriage was designed to be until you're centered on Him. And I know that's a wonderfully ambiguous statement, so come back to the Ephesians series when he preaches on what godly marriage looks like. But your marriage, your children, your hobbies, your leisure, your work, none of it will ever be satisfying and give you what God intended it to give you until you see it with reference to the Creator. And until you learn this, you will constantly be chasing for something more, something better, something shinier, because you have not learned the eternal beauty of contentment. There's a kind of joy and satisfaction bound up with thanksgiving as you eat, as you play, as you work. When these things are done with knowledge of the Creator and out of a heart of thanksgiving to Him, there's a simplicity to life and a satisfaction to life that does not terminate on life, but points you past life to the Creator and gives you satisfaction. And that creates a well of joy that does not fail. This is what Jesus meant when he told the woman at the well, "Everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him shall never thirst. And the water that I will give him will become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life." And so what Jesus is stating there is that he is satisfaction. He is contentment. And in him you will have all the fullness of what you were designed to experience. So the bottom line of Solomon's text is this. There is nothing under the sun that will ultimately satisfy. There is nothing under the sun that will ultimately satisfy. That's all you got to know. Men, women, careers, prestige, money, obedient children all make really poor gods. And so the sad part is that if you don't believe this morning, you will remain exhausted on the treadmill, running after nothing, searching for what's not there. And what's even sadder is you will have moments in your life where you think you've found it, but the reality is that while you think you found it, you've really only found the wind. And you will hop right back on that treadmill, exhausted. And so my final word for us this morning is this. Let us be a people who can actually have contentment under the sun, because we've set our eyes and our affections to something beyond the sun, where Christ sits at the right hand of the Father, and where the Psalms say there are pleasures forevermore. And let us delight in our Creator, knowing that Christ is enough and that He does not and cannot disappoint.